Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Well, I hope you all skated through any bad weather this past week. Northeast Ohio had its share of rain and lightning and thunder, and unfortunately we had some flooding. But that's all past right now, and the good news is I got a new bike this week. It's my first single in many, many years because I'm usually the stoker on the back of a tandem. So my partner Brian built it up while I wasn't looking. Turns out I walked right past it at the shop probably the other day, and he is sneaky that way. He brought it home to me this week. I immediately took a sideways tumble, scratching my brand new beautiful Brooke saddle. But being the trooper that I am, I got back on the horse and rode it down the road and back. Because it was getting dark, I couldn't get much farther than that, but I have to say it's a sweet ride. And if you want to see it, I've posted a picture of it on the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. It's getting a lot of whistles. Anyway, I'm not such a hotshot rider, but the hotshots took off in the prologue of the Tour de France this week, launching the 100th running of the famous and infamous event. It is still speculation as to the winner, so if you're a betting person, step right up and place your bet. You still have 3 weeks to go. Here's the official website of the tour and what they had to say about what's going to happen at the finish. It's a little different this year. It's the final day, and it's going to be incomparable in the strictest sense because we really wanted to pay full tribute at the end of this 100th edition. From the sporting perspective, there shouldn't be too many surprises. It's difficult to imagine the sprinters missing out. And if that sprinter happens for the fifth consecutive occasion to be called Mark Cavendish, then that really would be an extraordinary exploit. From the celebratory point of view, we have an unforgettable route, which will start in the gardens of the Palace of Versailles, past the monument to Jacques Anquetil, then go through the Garden of the Louvre before turning not in front of, but around the Arc de Triomphe. The finish will be at dusk around 9:45 p.m. It will be magical. And as we like to say in radio, stay tuned. I think it's going to be an interesting tour this year. Meanwhile, it's been pretty quiet on the Ulta Bike Share versus the D.C. Workers Front this week. There was a statement from Mia Burke sent to the Department of Transportation and shared with the Bike Portland org blog stating that, quote, "We are working hard to resolve the prevailing wage question for our Capital Bike Share workers. As such, we are providing the requested information to the Department of Labor and also completing an internal review. This is a very important issue to us, and we want to handle it right. As we are a very young company at the forefront of a new industry, we are learning as we go. We fully value our workforce and are proud of our success. In partnership with the District of Columbia in launching and operating a world-class bike share system with more than 4 million miles logged to date. When I am able to share the results and actions, I will do so." So for update about the worker side of the story, you can go to bikeworkers.tumblr.com. But to add more fuel to the fire, the Chicago Sun-Times ran an article about what will be the country's largest bike sharing program and the issues it is running into with what might be favoritism. Here is a brief excerpt by Sun-Times reporter Fran Spielman. "A rival bidder is trying to put the brakes on Chicago's plans to launch the nation's largest bike sharing program by claiming the path was greased for an Oregon company where Mayor Rahm Emanuel's transportation commissioner once worked. Josh Squire, owner of Bike Chicago, charged that transportation commissioner Gabe Klein, quote, tainted the process, unquote, by failing to disclose his prior relationship with winning bidder Alta Bicycle Share and did not really recuse himself from the selection process as he claimed to the Chicago Sun-Times. So I don't know what else can go wrong here, but we will continue watching the Alta Bike Share situation. But let's see what's going to go right this week. I'm going to tell you about the show. Reaching out across the aisle, Congresswoman Doris Mitsui, a Democrat from California who is a great supporter of bike ped programs, including Complete Streets and Safe Routes to School, introduced the Safe Streets Act along with my first guest this evening. Congressman Dave Joyce, Republican of Ohio. He actually represents a district very close to my home, and he'll fill us in on the details of the legislation and what he sees going forward for bike ped issues in the next term of Congress. My second guest this evening is Rob Gard. Rob runs, get this name, it's kind of cool, Ciclavia events in Los Angeles, and I wanted to know how he got the cars off the road for 3 half-days in 2013 to let people walk, ride, and have fun in what most people think of as mostly a car-centric place. After a break and some current news, we're going to head up to Woodstock, Vermont, and talk with a true veteran of the bicycle tour business, Larry Niles, who, along with his wife Dawn, owned Discovery Bicycle Tours, running out of Woodstock, Vermont. We will be talking about their recent name change and some of the interesting tours they offer. I'll also be asking Larry for some tips for those who want to try a supported bicycle vacation and about their weekend getaway tours. So as you can tell, it's another packed show. Let's get right to it as I welcome Congressman Dave Joyce to the Outspoken Cyclist. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Diane, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Last week, you reached across the aisle, as they say, and introduced the Safe Streets Act along with Congresswoman Doris Matsui from California. So what prompted you to bring this legislation to the floor?
Well, to me, this is personal. My interest in bike safety emerged is it two years now, unfortunately?
Yes.
When my friend Judge Chip Henry, who was hit by a car while out riding his bike, just innocently riding his bike after having dinner, and you began to realize at that point that, and especially in our neck of the woods, that the streets, if there's a way to bring them in compliance so everybody could be on the street, I mean, he was certainly in a safe area, but he happened to get hit by a motorist who unfortunately was intoxicated and killed him. And I just felt so bad about that. And then I read a shocking stat when I got here that between 2000 and, I think it was 2009, there was 47,000 pedestrian fatalities. You know, and we can fix this. Studies have shown that well-designed sidewalks, bike lanes, roadways, they can prevent fatalities and prevent injuries. And I really want to work forward with Congressman Matsui and get this handled.
So one of the questions that just came up, which, and you mentioned it, you know, in part of your district, Geauga County, there aren't a lot of sidewalks. So what kind of planning needs to go, and would that come under the Safe Streets Act? What kind of planning could we do out in more rural areas to bring people, like kids, back on the streets riding their bikes like we did when we were kids?
Well, by implementing complete streets, we'll improve the safety for cyclists. And while there's a lot of great bike paths in our area,
true,
you know, we have to access the roads, obviously, to get there. And if we just have a standard where everybody, all roads were built the same, I noticed more and more traffic out there, every weekend, more and more bicyclists, and God bless them. I mean, everybody wants to get their exercise, and I know I'm getting too old to jog, so I've been riding mine more and more, but it's one of those things that the roads should be wide enough for all of us, and there should be enough room for all of us, and if we implement all of the better designed roadways, then there would be enough room for all of us.
Expand a little bit on what Safe Streets, what's in that act? What is it that you and Representative Matsui are hoping to bring to Congress for some sort of legislation?
We see it's just a matter of better designed roadways. We have the ability to do this. It was just a matter of implementing the policy. And if everybody was on the same policy and how the roads were going to be laid out, then everybody knows where their spot on the road would be. Bikes, walkers, cars, horses. We have a fair amount of horses.
Yeah, we do. That's true.
So, as you notice, we made some to accommodate the Amish, obviously, out in Middlefield on 528. We actually have a buggy path along the road because, people there were, there's no, when the car was hitting those buggies, there's no relief.
That's true.
People were getting killed on a regular basis, so they created this, and the number of accidents with the Amish has gone way, way down. And so if we, you just think about that and carry that out for bikers and the rest of Americans who just want to get out there and exercise, well, let's do it.
I think you mentioned in the press release I received, there was a change in demand for safer transportation alternatives. So transportation, yeah, cycling is one, but it also includes public transit like light rail and bus and that kind of thing. And especially because you represent an area that doesn't necessarily, you're not downtown Cleveland where you can jump on an RTA bus or get on the rapid transit. How are we going to get from, say, you know, 306 and 322 to even to Hillcrest Hospital, which is, you know, like a five mile jaunt?
Well, while I don't have the city of Cleveland, I do think the Greater Cleveland Transit Authority has done a wonderful job implementing policies that are accommodating bikes these days. I was down there for a tour, and I noticed that it's one of the things that they picked up on. They said they were trying to do more and more is putting the bike racks on the cars or on the buses. But, you know, I think most people still drive to work, but there are plenty of things that we can do as far as bike walkers, some sort of combination. And the goal of the bill was to try to make streets safer, not just for adults, but for children playing or riding their bikes, or for transportation, as you said, for people who want to ride to work. I know my friend Judge Fury out there in Geauga County rides his bike from Parkman all the way to Chardon every morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for him.
In the summer months, that's great. You see people biking not only for transportation, but also for recreation. So why shouldn't they have just as much access to the road as the person driving a vehicle?
So your goal is to make things safer. Is there any safe routes to school stuff involved in this, in your Safe Streets Act? So, you know, like getting kids to ride together to get to school as opposed to everybody bringing an SUV and dropping their kids off.
I don't think we'll ever be able to change that policy, but
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. But the price of gasoline, maybe, is about the only thing that will break that.
But, yeah, maybe.
You know, if kids start, everybody talks about having to get people to, you know, the president's wife has a policy about move, and the NFL was putting on its policy about play 60 or whatever. Well, heck, I mean, just think of the things we do every day, like going to school. You know, or if you rode your bike to school, which, like we used to do when we were kids, you know, then there's calories burned off every single day.
And, right.
You know, the more active we get and just doing the things that we have to do every day, I noticed that when I got here. Heck, I'm walking 5-6 miles a day on top of my morning workout. So it's been good for me here.
Have you ever tried the bike share program yet?
No, I have not.
No, I have not.
How is it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not in D.C. You are.
I've seen them in the corners and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's been great. But, you know, for myself, the one thing is that everything's within a few blocks here for walking.
Right.
Reasons. But one of these days, I'm going to strap on my backpack and go down to the market with one, because I've seen I run into people who are asking me where they are, and I know where all the racks are. So I'll tell them, well, you just go right behind these buildings and you'll find it. But that's a tremendous idea. And they also have a thing up here with the cars, too. They got the little smart cars that you can, you know, rent for, you know, hourly or daily basis in order to shoot out to the grocery stores. So try to relieve the congestion here in town.
So you don't actually have to own your own car. You can actually rent a smart car for when you need a car and then just park it again.
You know, we get smart cars, we got smart bikes, and now we get some smart streets, we'll have it all going.
So when do you think this legislation is actually going to, you know, be brought to the floor so that people can actually perhaps vote on it, given what happens a lot of times in Congress these days?
Like, well, one thing I could tell you, Diane, I've only been here 6 months.
But, I know.
I can't predict anything here.
Okay.
I would like to think it would come sooner than later, but it's one of those things where it has to wind its way through the process, and the process, you know, I still haven't figured that out. But I don't know anybody who's really figured it out here in town. But as soon as we can keep it moving, I think you have to stay on top of it, and this is one in tribute to Chip that we're going to stay on top of.
Well, Congressman, thank you so much for talking to me, and thank you so much for introducing Safe Streets to Congress. I'm really looking forward to having it pass.
Thank you very much
All
for
right.
your interest in this, Diane, and your time today.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Congressman Dave Joyce joined me from his offices in Washington, D.C. He is the new congressman from the state of Ohio, actually, and he reached across the aisle to work with Doris Matsui, who is the Democratic congresswoman from, I think it's the San Francisco area in California, and introduced the Safe Streets Act, which everybody knows is important to cycling and pedestrian issues. And it sounds like he's having some fun down there in D.C. So we are going to go from the East Coast all the way out to the West Coast. And we're going to talk with a gentleman by the name of Rob Gard. He is the guy who runs an organization called Ciclovia. Rob, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about your organization and your events. So it's Ciclovia.
Ciclovia.
And so tell me, what is it?
Ciclovia is a open streets event that temporarily closes streets to car traffic and opens it up to traffic that includes bikes, pedestrians, skateboarders, rollerbladers, roller skaters, any kind of transportation you can imagine that does not use a motor.
I know you're going to do three of them this year, and two of them have already been held, one
Correct.
This past week. But walk us through how one works, because you're in Los Angeles, and just trying to understand how Los Angeles will allow you to close streets. First of all, that's the first mind-boggling thing. But tell us how one of the events works.
Sure. It is kind of a David versus Goliath here in Los Angeles, because we are such a car-centric city and it's such a car culture. But we have a lot of support, and I think the key for anybody who does an open streets event in any city is having a lot of support across a broad base. So we have support from the city, from the county transportation agencies, from county bike coalitions and other bike groups, from pedestrian groups, and it's bringing all of these people together under this same concept, the same direction of an open streets program that really allows us to take the steps needed to implement them.
So we had something called Rock and Roll here.
Okay.
Our friend Lois Moss, who is now in Portland, did that here in Ohio. And it sounds somewhat similar. I know your idea originally, though, came from Bogota, Colombia. So how is your event similar to what they do down in Colombia, and how is it different?
You know, what's actually an interesting side note in all of this is, if I recall correctly, the idea kind of sparked itself in Ohio. Because if you go way back 40-plus years ago, there was a young man from Colombia studying at a university, and I think it was in Ohio.
Oh, that's way before Lois.
So this is going way back. And he was during the late 60s and was in awe of the activism happening around cities and campuses at the time. And went back to Bogota to try to create that feeling of community with all these different people coming together. And really, Ciclovia, which is what they started in Bogota, came from bringing people together. And there it was implemented in a way that we follow that model now, is car-free, closing down the streets, the central streets of the city to cars, and opening up to bikes and pedestrians, and just having really a type of connection that you can't have when you're in your car.
Let's talk about the one you did that sounded really interesting to me, To the Sea. How
mm-hmm.
did that one work?
That one was our sixth overall, and it was our first one to leave the downtown Los Angeles area. Our first five were held there, and those tended to be, I think, maybe 9 to 11 miles in total with different streets. Here we only closed down, I want to say, 3 or 4 different streets, and it went nearly 16 miles from downtown all the way to the ocean along a boulevard here known as Venice Boulevard to a very famous beach called Venice Beach.
Right.
And it's a lot of work. We work very closely with the Department of Transportation and with the City of Los Angeles, as well as with emergency service personnel and law enforcement to determine which streets to shut down and how to control both the bicycle traffic and pedestrian traffic, as well as we have a number of crossings for vehicles to get across the route, and that those have to be certainly safely secured and monitored so that everybody can go the way they want to go without incident.
So obviously this is open to children as well as adults. How do you actually handle the numbers that you get, which it seems to me it could be in the thousands?
Yes, I mean, it's a great question. It's something that's difficult for first-timers to get their mind around. So the Ciclovia to the Sea, we had more than 200,000 people participate. And what's interesting to get your mind around is there's no start. There's no end. There's no entry point. It's your street as you would find it on a normal day where you just say, I'm going to get in my car and drive here, except it's your streets without cars. So what we do to encourage and support the family participation and participation of children was really highlighted in our Ciclovia this past weekend, which went down iconic Wilshire Boulevard here in Los Angeles. And that is, we activated a lot of spaces with activities, with music and food and cultural festivals and art festivals and craft workshops. And I think that really helps bring an appeal to families compared to just a straight bike ride.
How does it work in terms, obviously there is police that, who are helping to keep everything under control. Do you have any issues with crime or problems, or is everybody just happy?
To be honest, we don't. So we've had 7 Ciclovias, and I think we've had 2 incidents in those 7. And one was a minor incident involving somebody who wasn't a participant. It was actually a homeless person who just kind of got a little riled up over all these people, riding past them. And really, there haven't been any arrests in all 7, and we've had nearly a million people participate. The police department anecdotally says that crime goes down throughout the entire city during Ciclovia.
And I don't find that to be unusual. When you think about people in cars, that's when they sort of get all upset. You know, that road rage thing, it goes away when you're on your bike or you're walking or whatever. How do the merchants fare during this stuff? I'll bet they do well.
They do. Well, depending on your business.
I'm sure.
Most businesses do, but certainly if you are a gas station that's on the route and nobody can access you.
Yeah, there is that.
So, you're in trouble there. But it's great. We have such tremendous feedback from little restaurants and, specialty shops and even convenience stores along the route that are just overflowing with new visitors and, it's something you just have to see. And what's great is we hear from a lot of these businesses that people keep coming back, people who have never been to this part of the city, whatever part of the city the route goes through, will find a special taco place or a special stationery store, and they'll make that return trip back. And what's also important to know is that they understand that they can get to this place now by bike or by taking public transportation, which they didn't realize prior to Ciclovia.
Interesting. So it's opening up other people visiting specific neighborhoods, knowing that they can do it without, firing up their 3,000-pound car. That's awesome. I mean, we talk about that a lot on the show, about where you can go on your bike that you don't think you can. Let's say somebody's listening in Louisiana, and they wanted to start something similar. Where would you begin to do this kind of work in your city?
Well, certainly we're happy to be a resource for people and direct them in certain ways and share our expertise. There are some open streets advocacy organizations out there which have information about starting your own open streets events. And these are becoming more and more popular throughout North America, throughout the United States. They've been around for 40 plus years and are extremely popular throughout South America and Central America and Mexico, and happen every weekend, but we're just starting to get into them now. And I think as the more events that happen around the country pop up, the more other cities will see how it's done and can implement it on their own.
So it's Ciclovia, Ciclavia.org, and you said there are a lot of resources out there that people could get to. I think it sounds like a lot of fun. What's the one in October going to be?
So October, we're calling that our Heart of L.A. route, so to return the route back to downtown Los Angeles, where we've had the first 5, and it'll be our 3rd anniversary of going around downtown Los Angeles. A lot of people are looking forward to that.
Nice. Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to talk to me about your events and about what's going on in Los Angeles. We don't think of Los Angeles as always being bicycle and pedestrian friendly, and this sounds like it is. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
All right, Rob, have a good day.
Thank you. You
too. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Rob Gard joined me from his office in Los Angeles to talk about his events, Ciclavia, in the downtown streets of L.A., where they shut the streets down a couple times a year in three different areas and let you ride your bike, walk, skateboard, roller skate, do whatever you want, hula hoop, and just have a rockin' good time without worrying about cars on the street. I think it's cool. We are going to do some news, and then we're going to talk with Larry Niles of Discovery Bicycle Tours in Vermont. We are going to start our news with Angie Schmidt. Angie works for Streets Blog out of New York City. She has an interesting item about bikes on trains, and the title of the article is Amtrak Looking to Handle Growing Demand for Bikes on Board. Amtrak can be a great option if you want to travel to another city sans car. But if you want to take your bike on board an Amtrak train, on most routes, you'll have to dismantle it, at least partially, and fit it in a box that for a $10 fee can be stowed with the luggage. Once you arrive at your destination, you'll have to put it back together if you know how, before rolling away from the station. Only 8 Amtrak routes allow passengers to roll bikes on board fully assembled. Even those that do allow walk-on service only do so in very limited numbers. Most trains allow just 6 bikes per train, though if you have a folding bike, you can store it in carry-on luggage. But Amtrak is seeing increased demand for walk-on bike service across the United States. In California, demand for bike accommodations has been so overwhelming that Caltrain and Amtrak recently added a reservations system for walk-on bike service for the Pacific Surfliner. Before the policy, if too many passengers wanted to bring bikes on board, they were bumped, or at best, forced to hold their bikes in the aisle. Passengers in some states are still struggling to have non-folding bikes allowed on board at all. New York lawmakers are pushing Amtrak to allow walk-on bikes on additional routes out of Penn Station, saying it will boost tourism income for upstate New York. A coalition of lawmakers, including U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer and New York State Senators Betty Little and Bradley Hoylman, held a press conference urging Amtrak to include bike cars on 2 lines, the Adirondack and the Ethan Allen, serving the upstate area and beyond. Little has been advocating for walk-on bike service on Amtrak trains for years, and local bike groups and chambers of commerce around the state have been demanding it. The Saratoga Chamber of Commerce has so far collected more than 500 signatures on its petition to Amtrak President Joseph Boardman advocating for bike access on trains. When we think of Seattle, along with many other Pacific Northwest cities, we think of it as being a super bike-friendly place, but perhaps not. Seattle consistently ranks high on the top 10 list for bike-friendly cities, but the keynote speaker at an urban cycling symposium taking place at the University of Washington last week gave Seattle a scathing review. Professor John Pooker teaches urban planning and public policy at Rutgers University and has been studying cycling for the past 15 years. Pooker spent the past week in Seattle and Vancouver and said his recent ride into downtown Seattle proved highly stressful. The main marked bikeway, a shared lane on 2nd Avenue, gives riders a false sense of security, says Pooker. I found it extremely dangerous. It's an accident waiting to happen. We almost got doored several times. There were people trying to parallel park their cars right into the bike lane. What is there now is more dangerous than nothing, he said. By contrast, Pooker said he enjoyed biking other parts of Seattle, including the Burke-Gilman Trail and the buffered lane on Dexter Avenue. But all that paled in comparison to his rides earlier in the week in Vancouver, B.C., where the city has recently put in 6 miles of separated bike tracks. Pooker says it's clear Seattle should follow in Vancouver's footsteps. The latest update of the Bicycle Master Plan calls for more protected bike tracks. The plan is expected to be formally adopted by the Seattle City Council sometime this fall, but does not have funding. We are going to take a short break and come back with my last news item, and then we'll go ahead and talk with Larry Niles out of Discovery Bike Tours in Vermont. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now, before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
I'm Diane Lees. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I have one more news item to finish up, and then we'll scurry on over to Vermont to talk to Larry Niles. I know virtually nothing about investing. And in fact, I don't claim to. But I do know who the Motley Fool people are. And this week they had an online entry titled Time to Buy a Bike or a Bike Stock. So I'm going to start with their disclaimers because they end with them. But I just think this is interesting. So they say this post was created by Fool contributor Michael Hooper. Fool contributor Michael Hooper doesn't own any shares mentioned in this post. And the Motley Fool does not own any shares mentioned in this post. So those are their disclaimers. They begin, one of humanity's great inventions, the bicycle, has become a popular alternative to the gas-powered vehicle. Bicycling reduces traffic congestion, cuts greenhouse gas emissions, while improving one's physical health. People love bikes. But sales of Montreal-based Dorel Industries, Inc. were hurt in first quarter 2013 due to poor weather in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And worse, for the stock anyway, this trend is expected to continue. Dorel, the maker of Cannondale, Schwinn, and Mongoose bicycles, recently stated that second quarter sales will be sluggish and full year sales will not exceed 2012 sales as previously stated. The company plans to cut 50 jobs and record $2 million in severance in the second quarter. Worse yet, the sluggish sales environment is being compounded by widespread discounting by competitors in the bicycle industry. This won't be good for Dorel stock in the near term, but it may be a good time to buy a bicycle. Dorel stock fell 10% in the 5 days after cutting its bicycle sales outlook on June 13th. The stock has posted zero gain year to date through June 18th, while its competitors have posted double-digit returns. So this is an aside from me personally. There has been a lot of conversation about discounting of bicycles online. So I understand Cannondale, Schwinn, and Mongoose, who now are all made by Dorel, and Dorel is, it is a Canadian company, but I think most of the bikes are made in China, are finding that their bicycles are showing up in places they didn't intend for them to show up, like in gray, what we call gray market areas. So if that's hurting their business, I think that's kind of interesting. But just the fact, here's what they said, the foolish bottom line. Dorel has some great products, but weakness in sales and widespread discounting in the bicycle market will hold this stock down in the near term. Margins will likely not improve this year, even though Dorel is cutting expenses. Longer term, however, the bicycles should benefit from those of us who are looking for ways to reduce our carbon footprint and cut expenses for gas. Good news for Dorel. The market always has had a tough time figuring out what to make of Dorel and its unique mix of businesses. Interesting. I just think it's cool that bicycles were even talked about by the Motley Fool. So this comes from the Cyclists Being Treated Unfairly Department of Justice. It comes from Santa Monica, California. Los Angeles bicyclist convicted of assault with a deadly weapon in a Santa Monica crash. This is by Jason Islis. He's the staff writer for the Santa Monica Lookout. For the first time in Santa Monica, a bicyclist has been convicted of assault with a deadly weapon after an accident he caused by flouting traffic rules left a pedestrian with serious injuries, police said Tuesday. A judge ruled on May 31st that Los Angeles resident Rocky Martin's bicycle was a deadly weapon when he convicted him nearly 1 year after Martin struck a pedestrian in the crosswalk at Santa Monica Boulevard and 3rd Streets after running a red light. We want bicyclists to obey all laws, said Sergeant Richard Lewis, the police department spokesman. They are subject to the same laws as motorists. Martin was sentenced to 3 years formal felony probation and 30 days of community service after pleading guilty, Lewis said. During April and May this year, Santa Monica police have handed out 86 citations to bicyclists for riding on sidewalks, failing to yield for traffic signals and other infractions. But bicycle safety, Lewis noted, is a two-way street. On the same token, we ask motorists to share the road with bicyclists. Cynthia Rose, director of the local bicycle advocacy group, Santa Monica spoke, agreed that equal enforcement of the law for motorists and cyclists alike is important. We support equitable enforcement when it is enforced for bicyclists and motorists the same way, said Rose. But enforcement of the law isn't the only way to increase bicycle safety in Santa Monica. Along with this enforcement, we need to depend on SMPD and the city and our advocates to help with education, Rose said. But education needs to be part of enforcement. Lewis agrees. The Santa Monica Police Department is committed to educating the public on traffic safety and enforcing traffic violations. To address poor driving behaviors, the Santa Monica Police Department focuses on specific violations, Lewis said. In the past, SMPD has targeted drivers for tailgating, speeding, and distracted drivers. From July through September, they will be on the lookout for bicyclists who failed to follow the rules of the road. Since a road bicycle is considered a vehicle under the California Vehicle Code, bicyclists are bound by the same rules and allowed the same rights as cars. That's it for our news this evening. We are going to, as I promised, go up to Woodstock, Vermont, and welcome Larry Niles, owner of Discovery Bicycle Tours, to the Outspoken Cyclist. Larry, thanks for joining me this evening. We go back a long way. It's going to be fun to catch up.
Indeed.
Yes. So, you know, for many years, your company was called Bike Vermont. And I saw this thing come up on Facebook and it said Discovery Bicycle Tours. And when I clicked on it and sent you a message and Dawn sent one back, I'm like, I know those people. So when did you change from Bike Vermont to Discovery Bicycle Tours? And what made you do that? Not like it's a bad thing, obviously.
No, I hope not.
No.
We did it end of last year. It was sort of, it's a long process and it's been quite a process, I must say. Basically we were Bike Vermont, since 1977 and, we had a lot of people that associated us with biking in Vermont, but since, in the mid-1995, 1996, we started to expand, still predominantly Vermont, but then we moved to Ireland and then up to the coast of Maine and then to Scotland and then to Cape Cod and then Tuscany and Puglia and Quebec, and we opened up a tour in Spain last year and California this year. All of a sudden, Bike Vermont didn't seem like an appropriate name.
So how did you come up with Discovery? It's a great name, actually, I think.
Oh, thanks, thanks. Actually, we had a contest. We have many thousands of, luckily, people on an email list, and we sent out an email requesting ideas. And, what did we? We gave them, a free bike tour. Of course.
Wow. Why did I not know about this?
I don't know why you didn't get on that. But we had, I think Don said like 560 people come in with serious suggestions. And we went through and focused on, we had some very funny moments where we got very excited about some names. And then somebody sort of said, doesn't that sort of maybe suggest something else, and which would not have been appropriate for a bike tour company. And didn't think of that. You know? So thank you. It seems like a simple process and a simple name change, but it was actually quite a thing. But you know, you go online and you want to go to Ireland. Now we've been going to Ireland as long as any company in the United States has, or I think that's true. But you see Bike Vermont and then tours in Ireland and you go, you know, at least we think you would say, well, these people specialize in Vermont and it's sort of as a side thing to go to Ireland, which really isn't the case at all. So we thought it best to jettison the site specific or state specific name and become a little more global in our approach.
And I think that was probably a good idea. Okay, so let me ask you a different question. Between then and now, have you seen an increase in the number of tours booked, and do you attribute any of that to the name?
Yes. We, like most companies in the travel business, saw a decline in business in 2009, 10.
Sure.
This year we have we're seeing a really nice boost over last year and the prior years, and we certainly associated a lot with the name change. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and what we've been looking for, we have kind of a double-edged sword. 60%, 65% of our business is repeat customers, which is a tremendous compliment, and we love it. By the same token, we want to attract new business, and we've seen a big increase in new business from the name change, and I don't think anybody is left us because we changed our names. We made it pretty clear that we're the same people.
Sure, sure.
And we've accompanied that with a lot of media stuff. We have a brand new website, and we've got a very active, daily active Facebook page, Pinterest, Twitter, Flickr. We just started a new blog, which, by the way, has a great article written about us for the people that run the Off Metro website in New York and San Francisco.
They nice.
Went on tour. Really great article, yeah.
Yeah, nothing like good free PR. And
I know.
When it comes to social media, it seems like that's where everybody's going these days. So
yeah.
I'm going to break down your website a little bit, because you talk about end-to-end touring and how bicycling is, quote, only part of the experience. So what are some of the other, as you put it, special experiences in your end-to-end tours?
Well, each tour, of course, has its own specific highlights, but I guess the thing that's in every tour is the group bonding, the people bonding part of it, which is you wouldn't think of in terms of a bike tour, but it's a one. There, people are really like-minded. They're going on a bike tour together. They're not. It's not everybody that's going to do that. They have an interest in an active vacation, and what we see is tour after tour after tour, people finding good friends and keeping good friends, touring with them later, and just having a wonderful experience. I pulled down, when you asked me to be on here, I just pulled down the last few feedback sheets, and two of them. We send out a feedback sheet to everybody right after they come back on tour, and this one's dated June 25th, and it says, "It's funny how a group of people with a common interest, cycling, can be formed into a fun group in a matter of minutes." And the other one, which was the same day, yesterday, 2 days ago, "We really enjoy the camaraderie within our group. It made for a very enjoyable weekend." Well, that's not a specific thing, but
sure.
Things like stopping at a vineyard, and we either organize wine tastings or people just enjoy a wine tasting. There are vineyards, of course, there are vineyards all over the place now, but we have a couple of tours in Vermont that have vineyards. We have Quebec is a big wine growing area, and we highlight vineyards there. Of course, California, we're right in the in Sonoma, so we basically every day we're involved there. So there's a lot of that sort of thing. We there are little things like having a picnic by a brook, or we go by on two different tours I can think of right off, where there's a rope swing that goes off into a swimming hole, and a lot of our not young cyclists just decide that's the great.
You mean like you and me?
No, not that for sure. No, a Maine lobster feast up in Maine.
Yeah.
We have cooking demonstrations or hands-on cooking in Italy, in Puglia. You learn to make orecchiette pasta, and we have a lot of walking options, and walking is a lot. There's a lot of possibilities there. We walk along the cliffs overlooking the Pacific on our California tour. We have a guided walking tour in the Burn in Ireland. We have walking just a couple of places in Vermont, which we really encourage people to go to. We take everybody to an Irish pub in Doolin, and where they can, listen to them stamp their feet while there's fiddle playing and
sure.
drum playing.
So,
or the other part of it, which we really do emphasize, is you relax and do nothing. Just
even
be
better.
On an Adirondack chair and overlook the bay and over Lake Champlain. Well, we do kayaking on three of our tours. There's professionally guided kayaking. So there's all that kind of thing. But it's more the small moments that are unique to each person. Finding the perfect thing in an antique store, walking down the creaky boards of an old general store and that are all over the place still in Vermont, and just enjoying the people that that you intercept, because you're just on a bicycle. People are more friendly and welcoming, I guess, than if you're on a bus or something like that.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Larry Niles. He and his wife Dawn own Discovery Bicycle Tours out of Woodstock, Vermont. So one of the things that you do, which I think a lot of people feel that they can't afford, not just financially, but time-wise, to take a 5 or a 7 or a 10-day tour, you actually have some weekend tours, and that kind of was exciting to me. Tell us a little bit about your weekend tours, how those work, and when you show up like on Friday and go home on Sunday. Is that how that works?
Exactly.
Oh!
Yeah. That's. I'm trying to think. I don't think anybody else offers weekend. There may be a small company in northern Vermont that offers weekend tours. I'm not sure. We certainly are the ones that offer the most. Not that most is best, but we have wonderful weekend tours. We have, we do 26 of them in Vermont.
Wow.
And there are 26 different places, but there are 26 different tours during the season. We also have 4-day, 3-night tours in Vermont, just in terms of short tours, midweek. Two of them, they start on Tuesday and end on Friday. And we have a tour that starts on Thursday and ends on Sunday, so you can take a long weekend. But yes, you start on Friday. We offer free use of some really great bikes and, of course, helmets and all that sort of thing. So all you have to do is show up, and you have dinners and breakfasts and 2 days of riding, 2 liters and van support, and it's all contained in a short weekend. So
sounds wonderful. So how many people typically go on one of your, say, 5-day tours? I mean, do you limit the number of people, or do you have a minimum number of people? How do you choose how many people?
Good. Yeah, two kinds of things there. Maximum number, just because we don't think it's good to have more than 20 people on tour. So 20 people is a maximum.
Okay.
That said. Because we go from end to end, often there's 3, 4, even 5 tours on a tour. We have a lowest common denominator for the number of rooms that are available, and you can't just go marching around finding 15 room inns all over the place that are within easy distance of each other and good biking. So we sometimes we'll book an inn that's, let's say, has 8 rooms. That becomes the limiting factor for sure. So some of our tours have a maximum of 20. Some of them will have a maximum of, I think the smallest is 16 for a maximum.
Got it.
We're somewhat unique in that we will run tours with 4 and 5 people. I will only have 1 leader on tour instead of 2. And we let people know well in advance that it's a small tour, and give them the option of changing tours or postponing their tour experience. But a lot of people have made plans and really enjoy it, and so we will run a really small tour. And my thinking on that being basically, they'll have a good experience and they'll want to come back and get on a bigger tour.
And why would you discourage anybody if you can accommodate it?
Well, I don't discourage them. Every once in a while, and it's only happened a couple of times, I've had people say, gee, I wish we'd known it was going to be a small tour. They want a bigger group experience.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, I know it. You never know.
I would rather go in the other direction personally, but that's okay.
Well, I think the majority would. For whatever reason, most companies in this business will cancel a tour that's that small, but we don't. So.
Okay. Yeah. So I have a question about a tour that you offer that I don't think I've ever seen. Maybe other people offer it, but it is it's your longest tour. It's 10 days. It's the El Camino del Santiago in Spain. And I know a lot of people walk the El Camino. It is it's a pilgrimage of a sort.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did that tour come about? This is really personal interest for me, but I assume if I'm interested, there'll be other people interested.
We just finished that. That just ended on the 19th.
And how many people went this year?
Oh, it was small, like 8 people, something of that sort.
Okay.
Because it's longer, it's a little more expensive.
It's
almost $3,300, and I think maybe that's a limiting factor. Although the last time we ran it, I think there were 16 people on it. So I'm not at all discouraged. We had lots and lots of interest. We had one person was injured like 10 days before the tour.
And yeah, that always happens.
He was the leader of a group of 4, so all 4 of them had to cast off. So,
sure.
This was a tour. We have this wonderful person who's in charge of our Italian office, and Rosita Menghi, and she has spent her life leading tours in Italy, of course, but also in Spain and in France, and she's been always wanting to run this. She's cycled this many times, and she's always been wanting to run it as a bicycle tour. She said, asked if I would be willing to contemplate making it into a tour, and so that was her idea 4 years ago.
Nice.
And we're on the actual path on bikes, but there are, if you know about it at all, there are a lot of roads that's semi parallel it. So if people would rather not be on the path, you can go off onto a paved road and then come back on. We've got that all mapped out and all the directions on it. We don't do the course. We don't do the whole pilgrimage route because it's much too long even for a 10-day tour. But
right.
we do the part, basically the Spanish part of it. It's got wonderful history and beautiful area, and you know, going through the Galicia and all, and you get your stamp to show that you have actually done the pilgrimage, and it's quite wonderful with the ending being in Santiago de Compostela, which is just a beautiful, beautiful town.
Nice. You have over 150 starts, you know, different tours. Rank them as 1, 2, 3. What would you say your top 3 tours are? Can you? I mean, because some of they're all repeats. I mean, you do them several times each year, right? Except for
right.
the Santiago, of course.
Sure. Well, I mean, how rank them in terms of the
popularity.
Popularity. Actual numbers.
Well, not you don't have to give me the numbers, but it's sort of like,
okay.
What are the favorite 3 tours that seem to just get booked over and over again that people just rave about that are the favorites?
Well, it's a hard question because like we only do 3 tours in Ireland and they're pretty well full.
Okay.
And we do 14 tours in Maine and probably 10 of them are full. We're not full, but you know, are very healthy. I would say, you know, in terms of from Discovery Bicycle Tours point of view, the strongest performing tours are probably our Lake Champlain tour in Vermont, our Quebec tour, which actually starts in Vermont and then spends 4 days in Quebec and then comes back into Vermont, and our Coast of Maine tour. But, I mean, that's over a season beginning in, well, I'd have to throw California in there, too. This year was and has been extremely popular. But that's over a whole season, whereas July we have 3 Ireland tours and 3 Scotland tours. So
uh-huh.
If you look at them, you know, in terms of percentage of participation, they probably would be the stars, I guess.
Wow. So you also do custom tours, which I think is really a cool idea. So I have two last questions. One is, anybody ever fall in love on your tours?
That's a wonderful question. We just had our fifth marriage. Well, getting married in September.
Oh, my goodness.
Now I'm talking about bike Vermont and now Discovery Bicycle Tours. We had we have five marriages within our close family of leaders and staff. So that's our fifth marriage. We've had several people, more than that, I'm sure, start romances while on tour and have kept us up. And then usually, it's usually when they get engaged or get married that they actually tell us about it.
That's so cool.
We had a few years ago, we had... we were notified in advance and did this, and we created this big sign. And I can't be honest with you, remember now. Shirley, but I think it was Shirley, Will You Marry Me?
Oh, cool!
And we put it up on a covered bridge that we went under.
Nice, it's like one
route.
Of the Jumbotron.
Exactly, but the Vermont style.
Right, that's great. Do you guys still offer a paper catalog? Just to change
sure
the subject,
do, yeah.
Do you? Okay. Before we sign off, I want to let our listeners know. How they can find Discovery Tours, and I know that you have lots of different ways of finding you, so go ahead, shout them out.
Okay, well, discoverybicycletours.com.
Okay.
Is our website. We have, you can type in that in under Facebook, and you'll get all of our daily, if not twice daily, postings there. And also direct access to our website. info@discoverybicycletours.com. We'll get an email to us requesting a catalog or being put on our mailing list, or Larry@discoverybicycletours.com would be even greater, and tell me that that you've heard about me or the company through this great radio program.
Well, you know, it's been fun to catch up, and one of these days, I'm going to get up there and see you. We do go to the Adirondacks once a year. We're usually tied up with family, but boy, maybe I'm
going.
Yeah, that's where Brian's from, but I think maybe we should kind of wander over there. Well, Larry, this has been so much fun. I'm glad to catch up with you. Please say hello to Dawn for me, another wonderful person at Discovery Bicycle Tours, and have a great season.
Well, thank you so
All
much.
Right.
Thanks for having me on your program.
All right. Have
great.
A good day.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Larry Niles joined me from his office in Woodstock, Vermont. Great to catch up with him. I actually met him years ago. We used to put on an event called the Touring Open House at our store, where we invited tour directors to come in and talk about their tours, and he did. And he sounds the same. He sounds like he hasn't gotten a minute older. But I still like talking to him and his enthusiasm for bike touring. That's it this week on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week. Don't forget to jump on out to our Facebook page and join whatever conversations are going on. I hope you have time for a ride this week. Keep the rubber side down. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.